Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and I am joined today on Double Feature, the podcast that you're listening to, with Michael Kester.
Hi, I'm happy to be here today.
With Michael Kester, by Michael, you're joined by Michael. I put in like a preposition or something in there.
It's all right.
Grammar, okay. The shining component.
This is a film podcast, yeah.
Right.
We're going to cover a couple movies today. We're going to talk about a movie called Black Swan, which is about a really, really, really well-off, well-to-do sort of artistically person. And then we're going to do that with a movie called Patty Cakes $. Patty Cake Dollar is how it would actually be pronounced in English.
Thank you. That's the Penn Jillette pronunciation, Patty Cake Dollar.
Yeah.
He would love that. I'm going to send that to him.
That's kind of a movie. They're about different versions of Bootstraps. But I think Patty Cakes, if only because it's set in New Jersey, has a specific tone that's different than a movie that takes a place literally across a river in New York. And before we get to talking about either of these, which I'm going to spoil profusely, Black Swan. So if that bothers you, skip to halfway-ish, at which point we will be talking about rap legend Killa P.
Thank you. Also, thanks for not committing me to spoilers, because maybe I didn't want to spoil the movies.
Yeah, I'm gonna hard spoil.
If you just close your ears, because that's a voluntary thing humans can do.
Sure.
If you just close your ears every time you hear Michael's voice, maybe there won't be spoilers.
Yeah.
I'm gonna remain agnostic in regards to these spoilers on the future of today's show.
So the good news is we are simply just talking about the plight of women in American society. So that means that for every $1 that you give to the Patreon, we still get $1 as opposed to 70 cents if we were two female podcast hosts.
Oh, huge bummer.
So
yeah, that is at patreon.com/doublefeature. There's a movie on there I want to remind people about. I've just been feeling it lately, just because no one in my life has any reason to know about or watch that movie. So it's a nice thing I can only talk about here. But it's actually, I believe, the longest piece of content that I've ever done. I don't know about you. You've done some pretty long things for other Patreons and Kickstarters, right?
I mean, I fucked around, yeah.
Yeah, I fucked around.
I did an episode of Twin Peaks.
Well, I was going to say, I don't remember do you know how long that is?
I know that the original episode of Twin Peaks was 2 hours. I think we pared it down to like a cool 45 minutes or something.
Oh, that's nice. And a bridge. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. This is a half hour film set in the world of Double Feature, starring the two idiots on this show and also one person we know who can act.
Mm-hmm.
So that part was cool. That should have been the plot, is we discover a person who can act. That's not too bad, but we don't need another one of these videos. I hate when a light bulb goes off and then my conscious adult brain goes, don't make that. Don't.
Yeah.
You don't need to. You know how many good Double Feature Kickstarter show ideas I've had?
Oh, God, I know.
Or movie ideas?
Sure.
Just the worst. Just the worst. Anyways, patreon.com/doublefeature. We got a bunch of shows on there, old episodes, and that goddamn movie. As well as, I think there's some numbers, spreadsheet action on there. There's more things on there than I can even remember. And you keep the show going. All important factors. Keeping the show going, also kind of a theme. I feel like these are, in their own ways, underdog movies.
Yeah.
They are about trying to achieve a higher sort of, I don't know, degree of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something also I found the older I get, that I'm just never satisfied no matter what I manage to do or make.
Sure.
And I'm always going, yeah, but if I could just do this next thing, that's what I want to do.
Right.
That's what I want to do. So that's very much Black Swan, but also it's got some, let's just say, some body horror elements. Is that safe territory to just go, oh, cool?
Yeah.
I mean, there's swan parts. There's body horror stuff in it.
I know. So the greater question, let's just do the horror thing first. Is Suspiria a horror film? Sure. Is opera a horror film? I'll give it to you. Black Swan definitely uses those elements for sure.
Yeah.
It has to. Obviously, there's almost no way for me to watch a movie about ballet that I don't just go, this is kind of like Suspiria, except everything's different.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. There's some body horror elements, but as far as a horror movie, I don't think it. I mean, yeah. It does some things that are uncomfortable.
I mention it only because body horror, you know, usually I don't even have this conversation. Before, we talked about it last episode or a little while ago, but I think Sorry to Bother You is a horror film. Anything that weird looking people go watch, I'm like, must be a horror film.
Yeah.
My definition of horror is so fucking loose. But Black Swan, because it has, again, what I'll call body horror moments, that's of particular interest to me because I think body horror is one of the few sort of subgenres of horror that doesn't get done very much. I can't think of very many films modern day that, you know, we think body horror and we talk about a little Carpenter stuff. We, mm-hmm. of course, I'm just trying not to immediately slam onto the Cronenberg, which is always where you go. And there's a few interesting people doing no kidding horror films today that are body horror films. But it's not exactly one of those elements you just weave into your fucking drama.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the things I think is the coolest about this, that there are parts of it that borrow from a terribly like inaccessible, icky area of cinema. And that's also been one of my favorite things about Aronofsky, who's a director I liked a lot more when I was younger. And then, you know, I really found the tiny elements of his films that I loved. And I found people who just slammed them in your face for 2 hours. And I watch mm-hmm. a lot of their films. It's the tiny martyrs elements that I'm, right. that I'm just like, you know, the nastiest moment of pie, those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really cool that there's somebody who's pretty fucking mainstream.
Yeah.
Who is making things like Black Swan and eventually Mother. For as much as people were all over the map on how they felt about it, it's just like for that to be a mainstream movie is a pretty incredible feat. And it's also a huge leap. And then Black Swan kind of makes sense in the course of the films where sure. like, oh, we're going to dabble in some weird here mm-hmm. and then come back to some good drama elements.
Sure.
It's disgusting and beautiful at the same time, which I like right. tonally about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the whole point of the movie.
It certainly is. It's almost like there's a black swan and thanks. A white swan. Michael, thank you. I could barely get that out.
There's a black swan and I get it.
I have a really hard time talking about Black Swan because it's also one of those things where I feel like what it's doing is so crystal clear.
Sure.
That to do our usual analytical thing sort of seems like talking down to someone.
Maybe, yeah.
You know
I
what
think
I mean?
That, I mean, so here's the thing about, so I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's a podcast called Double Feature
uh-huh.
that elevates itself by taking a movie that is about as obvious as getting beat over the head with a swan.
Is this a Bjork podcast? Is that what just happened?
And then
but we already did that movie.
And then you get to compare it to a movie that really is unrelated, and then the themes become relevant as opposed to the movie itself.
Ooh, I like this. I like this.
And
what
so
a great angle. It's like you know how to do this. So perhaps we can use some of these thematic things to line up a more of an undersung movie.
I think that one of the things about Black Swan that we need to talk about, because it's more difficult to get into with Patty Cakes if we don't, is about the forfeiture of sexuality to achieve success in both of these films, but this film particularly. It's a really interesting sort. I mean, it's gross. It's a thing. It's like Harvey Weinstein, bleh. But it's a dynamic that this movie uses a little bit less than Patty Cakes, which is the notion of pussy power, let's call it.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Obviously, it's a despicable thing for somebody to coerce anybody sexually in order to promise them what they want, right? In this case, a role in a play.
Yeah.
But if you flip that and you coerce another person to giving you something in exchange for something you don't mind giving up.
By using your sexuality.
Right. As in the next film literally uses the word weapon.
Sure.
It's an interesting dynamic for me because I don't think in this movie it's necessary. I think in this movie they play, of all things, for some reason, they play that element very coyly.
Mm-hmm.
I think partially because I feel like if Darren Aronofsky were to really shine a light on that aspect of the film, it would take away from what he wanted to say, which is that man has a duality and there is a good and bad side to every person. And yeah, I know I've watched more than 10 movies. So I should also digress. The first time I saw Black Swan, I thought it was lame. And then the second time I saw Black Swan, I confirmed that it was lame. And then 8 years later, I watched Black Swan for a podcast and went, huh.
And confirmed that you were lame.
I was lame.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, right. Exactly.
I wasn't going to bring this up, but now let me just ask you. There's a fucking hard question in here that is very double feature.
Ooh, I hope you're asking the question I want to get to.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Should we do it? Let's do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What's a life lived not doing it, so to speak?
That's what we're here for. You just mentioned when it would be too hard, too easy to have a conversation about Black Swan.
So ask me what
a man wants to know about what the thing I just said. Go for it.
All right. And I'll frame this in a very double feature way too. I'm even going to invoke an early Blumhouse film.
Ooh.
Oh. The one that everyone's seen and doesn't know is a Blumhouse film.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Vincent Cassell's in this movie.
Sure.
He's the director, and as the director, he seduces, as it's called, in his mind, seduces this woman, which just means grabbing her genitals,
mm-hmm.
which literally we all as a country made fun of as a thing no one does and cannot really be done,
mm-hmm.
and is literally done in Black Swan, a cautionary tale about the 2016 election.
Mm-hmm.
16? Jesus, has it been? Okay, anyways, whoa. I guess that was about to take a dark turn for a second. So his idea is that by seducing this woman, by being gross to this poor lady, he can help unhinge her to mm-hmm. embrace her darker side, her mm-hmm. more manic side, her black swan, to loosen up from her rigid 28 but still lives with mom like she's 12 life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's about a person forcing, you know, they're basically an arrested mm-hmm. adolescence and maybe, you know, in cautionary tale terms, the very violent outcomes of that, of repressing someone that way. Okay, great. A lot of baggage in there. But let's talk about the character of that director. Here's the deep niche art take that no one's asking for. Is there a Whiplash element to this?
Sure.
Whiplash, as you'll remember from the studio who brought you The Purge
mm-hmm.
for the first Purge. In Whiplash, we talked about someone who is abusive as a teacher
mm-hmm.
and enduring the abuse because as a pupil, you want to do everything physically possible short of and maybe including your own death to become the best pupil of all time,
mm-hmm.
including a sort of consensual, yet quasi-abusive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So we had our opinion on that show, which was sort of like shrug, maybe, as our opinions always are. Mm-hmm. Shrug, I don't know. Would you do it? Maybe I would. Does a trashier, rapier version of that push our opinion away? What do you think about that?
Well, let me add one more layer to your already incredibly difficult.
One, do you understand like where I'm coming from?
Yeah,
the
totally.
Question?
Absolutely.
So that makes sense.
Totally. I think the other layer is that there's a Hay Hoffman element to this.
How do you mean?
Hay Hoffman is now going to be my shorthand for that thing I always talk about with Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman.
Sure.
Laurence Olivier put on some makeup to look sleepy and Dustin Hoffman didn't go to bed for 3 days to look sleepy. And then on the day of shooting, Lauren Olivier said, "Hey Hoffman, it's called acting. You should try it sometime."
Sure.
So I feel like because this is a stage play, there's a Hay Hoffman element. You know, if you need to stab yourself to be the Black Swan, you know, Hay Hoffman, like, Which doesn't make your question any easier for me, because I feel like when you're going into something, and I think you have to swallow the gravitas of this role and this performance and this show that the film itself is purporting, because like personally, I don't necessarily think anybody should even be like in the proverbial gray area of rape in order to be the black swan.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, it just doesn't seem like it's that important of a thing to nail.
Sure. But,
you know, for some people it is, especially like, and that's the thing that I think I wanted to show with these two movies is there comes a certain aspect of self-sacrifice when you're dedicating yourself to an art like this, where failure to become the lead in Swan Lake is a one-to-one equivalent of failure in everything you've ever worked for your entire life.
Yeah.
This film and the next are both about characters who have essentially sacrificed everything other than the one thing they're pursuing. They don't have much of a home life, don't have a social life, don't have, you know, they're the kind of person that goes, what's free time? And it's through that lens that I think you have to go by whatever means necessary.
Yeah.
When you're looking at the achievement of this role. And so I think if I'm going to answer your question, which I'm not, but if I were, I would say that if you were to take this character that Natalie Portman is playing and you were to go to her at the beginning of the film, you were to approach her at the beginning of the film and go, listen, I'm holding the script to your next 3 months. It says here that if you engage in a sleazy sexual relationship with the director, you get yourself emotionally ransacked by a potentially lesbian relationship that you don't pursue, and you actually physically harm yourself by stabbing yourself in the stomach. It says here you can be the lead in Swan Lake. You might die.
But it will be perfect.
Exactly.
She forgot about her fall. But except for that part, it will be perfect.
if you were to tell the character at the beginning of the film that's what she needs to do to reach what we're to believe is her goal.
Sort of seems like she'd say yes.
Right?
I think a lot of people would argue that you don't have the ability to consent there because of the power dynamic.
Sure.
That's an area that is, you know, you want to talk about.
Is this like a sort of adult statutory situation?
God, I mean, you couldn't give this any more baggage, really. There is, I mean, the Black Swan does kind of an amazing thing in hindsight, in that the unreliable narrator elements might just help push it back just enough towards reasonability,
mm-hmm.
that you can have some of these conversations, because large parts of this could be her own imagining that mm-hmm. she would be willing to cross lines that she has never crossed before. And maybe that flirtation with danger is more on her than him. You know, there's all the stuff she sort of sees at the end that doesn't happen. There's the magical realism elements, but there's also, there's a really amazing, it might just be a happenstance edit, but let's give everyone credit for it. There's this kind of sheepish, shy grin that Vincent gives her when she kisses him at the end. And it doesn't say, I have crafted you, my princess. It sort of says, look at this crazy, excitable girl and what mm-hmm. she's doing. And it's just enough for me in my head to let this alternate narrative play out that gives the film less baggage that way.
Mm-hmm.
But we're just talking in circles over and over about the lines of consent. I will say the one thing that I can add that I feel on firm ground about,
mm-hmm.
that people might disagree about, but I strive, and this is all Green stuff. This is all Adam Green stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these people around him feel the same way, and we've had so many conversations about this. And this is something that I think he talks about a lot publicly, but if you think you can do something besides art, do it. Art is for the people who cannot, will not do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's for people like Killer P,
mm-hmm.
who we'll see in the next movie, who if it wasn't this, it would be nothing.
Right.
If there is a backup option, if there is a plan B, if you could be happier doing anything else, don't be a fucking artist. Mm-hmm. Do that. That art is for the tortured souls, the people who just crave it at obsession to a perhaps monstrous capacity. And it's very, very interesting to me, those people.
Mm-hmm.
They're incredibly interesting to me. They're going to do some twisted stuff, and we're going to explore it through movies that people make about it.
Sure.
Which is a great way to sort of encapsulate Black Swan, I guess. But I don't know that that's necessarily, I feel like, look, here's, so can I give you an interesting thing on patty cakes that I felt?
Hell, why not?
What I love about patty cakes is a fuck ton of things. This is a truly undersung film from 2017. I only know one person in the wild who's ever even seen this film or talked about it. And more people should.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody would love this. I don't know why people don't see this. But look up Patty Cakes. Go see it. We're going to spoil it. There's a process that is illustrated in this movie that we get to see sometimes in mm-hmm. films, which is the process of artistic creation,
mm-hmm.
the sculpting of art. And I fucking guarantee you that you feel different about the artistic merit of one of Patty's songs at the end of the film than you do at the beginning of the film.
Sure.
Not because the song got any better, but because you saw the process making it.
Sure.
And it's something that just doesn't get translated enough. You know, when you watch a movie being made and you see the process, even if you have nothing to do with it, out the other end, you know why choices were made, you get why stuff was done, and it just sort of endears you to it. And these songs that you might write off in the beginning, seeing the kind of process and you being there with them suddenly makes you really excited when they pay off. And I think genuinely creates, you would listen to the song ironically before the film and after the film, you would genuinely go like, hey, these are actually pretty good songs.
Right.
Which is nuts to me.
Well, this whole movie, honestly, it tackles a few things in modern hip hop that I think nobody's talking about because they're quantifiably unimportant.
SoundCloud, trap. What are we talking about here? Oh, those are those actual things?
Well, I think one thing is that their demo. You remember? So you live in a place that's not Chicago now, which is also. That's a similar factor of the place I live, that it is also not Chicago. But when you and I did live in a place called Chicago, you would be walking typically near the Metra trains, which take you out to suburbia. You'd come in or be going out to suburbia, and on the bridges that you have to cross over the river, this is just the vivid picture that I'm remembering. There were these guys, and they were just standing there, and they had fucking Walkmans, and they would stop you the way that a homeless person asking for change would stop you, except instead of go, do you have any change, or can you spare something, or homeless, hungry, they would go, hey, you like rap?
Yeah.
And you go, yeah, I guess, especially if you were white, because you felt ashamed saying no.
I wonder if they knew that. I wonder, they must have been hip to that, right?
Maybe. And so you'd be like, yeah, no, I like rap music. I'm down with the hip hop. And
meanwhile, Michael is going, I hope there's no quiz.
Yeah. And then they would go, cool, check this out, and they'd hand you the headphones and you'd put it on, and then they would play their own music for you.
Oh yeah. I've always been, and this is big in Hollywood. Down on the strip is people handing out or selling CDs.
Yeah.
Super huge. That's actually a huge, I know you don't watch Mr. Robot, but that's like a huge fucking plot point in the first season is a dude handing out his rap CDs. Yeah.
And so they kind of show the process by which people, because I have a musical background for anybody who is new to the show. And I am one of those people. So there's a lot of people who have musical backgrounds. There's people like you who have recorded albums and recorded music for somewhere between zero and maybe $1,000.
Sure.
Then there's people like me who have an album that costs $25,000 to make.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's an outrageous amount of money that can go into this process. And I think one of the disparities between Patty and the character from Black Swan is, to me, the character from Black Swan is making a $25,000 record.
Yeah.
Patty doesn't have $500.
Right.
And so from the standpoint of bootstraps, you have these characters who, I mean, and I don't, you know, ragtag Breakfast Club style, whatever, sure. But the reality is they have nothing to start with but passion and talent. Nothing. There's no ground for them to even stand on. To go back to what we were saying before, these are characters who, they don't have a day in, day out that isn't trying to make it or trying to survive. That's sure. It's a binary switch.
The hustle, man, totally.
And so to show that aspect of the up and coming hip hop community, show that, I mean, like, the thing that's really vivid to me is when they take their promo photo and put it on the cover of the Jewel case with a burned disc inside.
Yeah.
That's so vivid
yeah.
to me, you know?
Well, because also the 25,000 plus people mostly started at the printout photos and put them on the burned disc, you know?
And then on the other side, the other thing that I think this movie tackles that's really important and really interesting, sort of the idea of being a culture vulture and the fact that in 2017, white people love rap, but it's still definitely a black thing. It calls into question the identity of a rapper. Do you really, is it a requirement for a true rapper to be black? And I don't, you know, like Eminem, sure, whatever, he did a thing. But like, honestly, does, you know, is it, if we're talking about a Fargo style checklist, is it, from a purist standpoint, you know, that she has this guy who's made it go, essentially he goes, you're white. I don't care what you have to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't care what you have to say. It's sure. not even that you're not good at rapping. He doesn't even, that seems like unimportant even up to the end of the movie. It's that he goes, I don't care what you have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is an important distinction, because if he went, you can't rap, then she goes, watch this. And then she raps mediocrely, but you know, we're a primarily white audience. And the average person goes, wow, what a good rapper.
Sure.
But he's not even, he's beyond that. He's like, sure, whatever, you can rap. Like, Andre 3000 goes fast. You can probably do what Andre 3000 can do. But the difference is, I don't care what you have to say. Even if you say the same thing I'm saying, it comes from a different place.
Sure.
And then the whole movie painstakingly goes, does it come from a different place?
Well, look, somebody else can school me on this, but I don't believe in borders. I don't like tribalism. I don't like when we all divide ourselves into different groups and we don't pick up each other's stuff. I think it's unhealthy.
But do you think how far does that go for you? There's got to be a line, right? Because like, I can't walk around just being like, no, I'm black.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, why do you got to draw lines in the sand?
I'm sorry, man. It's a challenging show. This is double feature.
I just be like the obvious stuff, Michael? Don't do it. Yeah. And the not obvious stuff. That's okay. Obviously, yeah. The trick is fucking finding the line. I'm mostly, you know, I think I once stated that I'm the sort of hypocrite who thinks everyone should have thicker skin and also be nice to me about
sure.
it. So, I mean, that's where I stand on all sure. issues. I mean, I feel yeah. the same fucking way about this. I feel like you don't hear many rappers complaining about that. You mostly hear audiences complaining about mm-hmm. that. I also think it's totally within your right, if you are a black rap mogul, to only be interested in sharing the stories of other black rap moguls. Mm-hmm. The Sundance Institute we talked about on Ryan Coogler's show has this partnership with Forest Whitaker. And actually, speaking specifically to black culture, they've made a couple films, Sorry to Bother You is one, that are done through that studio and then through partnership with him. and it's about promoting voices of diversity. And I think that's awesome. As a person who has depression, I would want to help other filmmakers with depression.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anything wrong with seeing the struggles that other people have and wanting to help lift them up. And you know, you lift up things you identify with.
Sure.
So that's definitely, there's no but to mm-hmm. that. That's just a thing, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think you're fine to choose your own choices. And so if this dude is going to come along and be like, bleh, cultural appropriation, then I guess that's within his right. But you know what? If she gets hot, then it's his fucking fault for not wanting to invest in that particular project.
I mean, I think what's interesting about this movie is that it calls that out point blank. I mean, it's a dialogue in the film. But to say, I'm not interested in what you have to say, I'm not interested in your story, halfway through a movie about an individual, is a really interesting move from a writing standpoint, from a cinematic standpoint, from a storytelling standpoint. The film has basically orchestrated a scenario where everybody who is 45 minutes into Patty Cakes has accepted that we are interested in what Patty has to say. We are interested in her story.
And I think the movie's endeared us to
right.
that as well.
And so when he goes, I'm not interested in what you have to say, I would be hard pressed to believe that everybody in the room, other than somebody who didn't like the movie at the onset for the reasons called out therein, everybody probably goes, dude, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And even the people who, maybe not me, but could be me in a certain mood, who might feel that way, would be like, ah, you know, it's making a point that I didn't expect that I would be that far invested in your side of it.
You could see a movie from that dude's perspective.
Right.
Where halfway through you get to that room and he says that and you totally back him.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the movie we're watching. And I think that says something about cinema, right? It talks about a narrative's power to endear us to a particular character through following them, through liking them and their struggles. And just like we're always looking for the best things about the movies on the show, I find just in my own exercise that the less baggage I bring to pieces of art, the more I enjoy them, the more I hear what they're saying, the more I start a conversation by listening rather than by giving a monologue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is just not the best way to receive. And this isn't a movie. If I come to this movie with a fucking anti-New Jersey bias, with any number of fucking biases, then I'm not going to be around when it's talking about the things that I do relate to, the kind of like trying to make it art life thing. And I think also a lot of people who, that's really the problem of the dude sitting on that couch, is he doesn't remember what it was like when he mm-hmm. was making his $1,000 fucking mixtape.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's onto a new set of problems and he's onto new challenges. Or maybe part of his identity is coming from that. And I don't think you see that a lot in rap. I think most of it, because it is so storytelling based, the struggle is more important than anything else
mm-hmm.
and continues to be today. You know, when I watch this movie, the part that speaks to me a ton, even today, is hood rat life.
Mm-hmm.
Is just that. It's actually funny to think about it in terms of hip hop, right? Because of Dyant Word and like Zeph.
Mm-hmm.
And the core of what that really is having nothing and still feeling the need to bling out.
Yep.
And that kind of speaks to that same, you know, you want to have this big flashy style, you want to be able to show off and impress in terms of your music and in terms of your art. But at the end of the day, you also got to do this catering job to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to have those two things at once, and then also aspiring to, just as the sort of legend of Zeph was about these like imported American rap magazines to South Africa, that was wanting to get out. That was sure. wanting to leave an sure. impoverished place and go to the sparkly, shiny place that you aspire to. And that's these kids. that's the entire dream that also was just a big thing I can identify with is suburbia. Mm-hmm. And wanting to leave. You remember fucking growing up in the suburbs and you got out to Chicago before I did.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to get out of the fucking, if you could only leave the suburbs, mm-hmm. it's like a prison that you're in. And at the time, suburban life was not an interesting niche to me at all. The last thing you'd want to do is set a movie in the suburbs. But now I've lived outside of the suburbs so long that it does have some sort of kitschy appeal.
Yeah, you become Joe Dante. Eventually, we all become Joe Dante.
Right, because we go, oh yeah, we couldn't see it at the time.
Yeah.
But that was real fucking weird, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What a strange place for us to live. But a big part of living there was everyone's desire, if we could only make it out. Now I live in Los Angeles. And I don't think about, oh, if I could only make it to LA, then everything would work.
Mm-hmm.
I worry about all these other fucking LA problems. But the problem of if I could just get to where things are happening is a piece behind me and one that I could be taking for granted if I don't allow myself to be open to hearing that conversation, to seeing a movie that in a way, I think for me anyways, made me appreciate some of what I have.
Mm-hmm.
And how far I've actually come with not nearly as much raw talent as any of these people who are able to sit in a room and come up with a something after 20 minutes of work.
Right.
I can't remember the last time I did. I'm not even sure we do that on this show.
And this is something that I think is really interesting about the types of people you see in Patty Cakes is, and this is something, man, I don't know, man, here's some risky territory.
Great.
I feel like when you look at the types of people in Patty Cakes, I feel like you have, so let's just look at the band, right? PB&J, and then let's eliminate all the dead characters.
Spoiler.
So I feel like,
The dead characters are doing that themselves, aren't they? Isn't that the nature of death?
Sure. Fair. Yeah.
Okay.
I feel like two of the characters, regardless of their talent level, are really, really certain of their talent level.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they're not that good, honestly. I'm not even going to be coy about it. I think that Patty and...
Yeah, are you worried about hurting these fictional characters' feelings?
No, I think that Patty and Jerry are mediocre at best.
Oh, interesting.
I think that the Antichrist
that is
would have a legitimately promising career if Death Grips didn't already do that. And so, but I think that he is legitimately talented. I think that that's evidenced by the fact that he makes all his own music and is able to basically take these other maybe talented, maybe not people and go, now you have songs, something they didn't have and weren't able to do before. But my point is to go back to what you were saying, you and I come on the show and we spend, depending on the day, between 10 and 35 minutes going, I don't know if I'm ready to do a show. I'm afraid it's going to suck. We don't say that to each other, but we know that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
We basically have to like prime ourselves and one another to feel like we are relevant or interesting enough humans to do something we've been doing for a decade.
Yeah.
I would postulate that part of the reason for this success of the characters in this film, but also most artistic success, comes from being too dumb to know to second guess yourself.
Hard agree. Hard agree.
If I were in the room, if I were a fifth person in the room when they were doing PB&J, I would be like, guys, this is fucking stupid. Meanwhile, nobody was there to tell them this is stupid. And then they get to the end and I go, okay, fair enough. That wasn't that stupid.
That's actually the number one thing that I think drugs help with.
Yeah, I agree.
I've been around too many creatives that do drugs. And I don't think it's as useful for expanding the consciousness as these people think, but their sort of blind sense of self-importance and what's that thing they call? It's like a sense of grandeur, right? Like a false sense of grandeur.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's one thing to be like, I'm going to make films. I'm really going to do something interesting. But then you get really fucking high and you go, what if the bratwurst was Nazis? And then you make it anyway.
In his defense, I think Kevin Smith was probably in the hospital on painkillers or something. Fair. When he did that.
So either way, that film is my point in a nutshell, because there is absolutely 0% of that movie that I would have even put on paper, let alone taken to full fruition. And then when I sat in that theater and watched it, I went, this is kind of fucking awesome.
But you know, the thing is, you get better with practice. When you waste time going, guys, this might suck, which is what I waste about 95% of my artistic time on, going, same. I shouldn't do this, it's bad.
Yeah.
Then you don't get the practice of doing it. Yep. And also, you never know what's going to connect with people. And I would say it was funny when you mentioned the different characters, because I think the reason that I see so much potential in Patty and not the Antichrist.
Yeah.
Not to say that I don't for him either. I could make an argument for 2/3 of the characters. Whatever, it's fine. That's what autotune was invented for. Listen, the thing I was going to say is that Patty lives the art life. She gets up and she does a rap to herself in the mirror when she's brushing her teeth. And she does a rap to people she's talking to. And she thinks in fucking lyrics and limericks. And she has dreams about it. She immerses herself in it often enough that the talent, I don't think, is as important, because she will practice the fuck out of it until she gets there. Whereas that dude hanging out in that cabin, if someone didn't come along to help him network with other people, he would... it's that fucking thing everybody's talking about right now about Van Gogh. I don't know if you're familiar with
it.
Right.
Yes.
So, you know, poor networking, right? It's a part that artists hate to accept, but it's an important part of the life, is getting the stuff out there. And also the ability to collaborate in that respect. And that's true of music, and that's very true of film.
Yeah.
And if you can't do those things, I mean, that is part of the art. The art is not just sitting around dreaming up magical concepts, because half the movies with snappy concepts are terrible, and half the movies with no concept wind up to be Black fucking Swan. You know what I mean? So like, I don't know, what if like girl wanted to do Swan Lake, but it was like a real life with Swan Lake? Cool, Aronofsky. Yeah. And then you get together and you actually work on the craft.
Sure.
And you mill it and you refine it and you sculpt it and it turns out amazing.
Right.
Unlike this show, double feature show, patreon.com/double feature. What are we doing next time on the show with a pause for producers? Because cool. I don't know how to, no refinement, no.
Next time on the show, we you and I tried a game to come up with how to pair movies on double feature, and it was really successful, and this was almost the fruit of it, but we changed our minds.
It was a game to generate, much like the game to generate plots.
Yeah.
The sort of license plate-esque card game I play. This was a game to generate double features. Mm-hmm. We've never done it before. It was amazing. And then we got rid of the amazing results because we came up with a better idea just out of nowhere.
Because our plain talent succeeded instead. So Ross, who's a person who likes our show, he's an avid double feature. I believe he's listened to every show and maybe seen almost every movie we've covered.
That's fucking amazing. Also amazing, Aaron Shore, Abbott of Unreason, Athena Banks, Ben Ecker, Charles Crawford, David Anderson, Jordan Sells, Keisha, Mark Abbott, and Tom Leonard. The executive producers of the show, that's patreon.com/double feature. Is this annoying people? Write me a tweet, @PlingMichael.
Ross wanted us to do Nice Dreams, which was a movie you didn't know what it was. I'm just going to say what the game was. I went, okay, so we're going to pair a movie with a movie called Nice Dreams. And I said, don't look it up. Give me a movie that goes with Nice Dreams. And every time you do a bad job, I will give you a clue as to what Nice Dreams is about. And we went through and I gave you clues. And eventually we came up with a really good pair, which is Nice Dreams and The Lure. And then you went, what's that movie where Robert Pattinson has like a bottle? And I was like, oh shit, that's even better. So we're going to do another movie that came out fairly recently that's fucking incredible. It's called Good Time. And then we're going to pair that with Nice Dreams. And I'll be honest, part of the reason that this took over The Lure and Nice Dreams is because to do a double feature called Good Time and Nice Dreams is too fucking funny for me.
Yeah.
The joys and hijinks of dealing drugs. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.